This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
Vote on health care delayed again. We'll find out why on The Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Patriot Preacher, covering the news from a Christian perspective. Glad to be with each and every one of you this Friday morning. Thank you for joining the program here on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Now, this news is just coming up. Word of this has just gotten around this morning. It's so new, it's not even on my notes, so I'm doing this completely off the top of my head. Now, based on what we're seeing, it looks as though the same thing happened that happened before, in the sense that it looks like they didn't have the vote, so they decided to just not have the vote. That's the news that's being reported. But the interesting thing is, it's happening the same way, but it's happening for the opposite reason. Because you'll recall, last time they attempted health care, one of the reasons that they made that big push, and unfortunately it wound up falling on its face, and by that I don't mean unfortunate because the bill didn't pass because it was a terrible bill, it was unfortunate that it was attempted in the way that it was, is that Paul Ryan got together with all the usual players in Washington, including the moderate Republicans, the insurance lobby, all the big business interests, and then crafted a bill that really would have barely changed anything, if at all, and it wound up getting voted down. Now, with this new bill, it too is not a full repeal of Obamacare, but it does change several of the parameters surrounding Obamacare. This one's a much deeper cut, and what was interesting is the reason this one wound up getting scrapped is for the opposite reason of last time, because now it's the Freedom Caucus that is pushing this bill and the moderate Republicans that are afraid to vote for it. Now, there are a number of different concerns that have played into this, and you wouldn't be able to say why each individual member is voting for it or against it. I mean, that would take forever to go through all the different Republicans. But it seems to be the consistency of the moderates, that they have a consensus that the big problem that they have with this one has to do with the individual mandate. As you'll recall, the individual mandate, in other words, mandating that you have insurance and coupling that with the whole pre-existing conditions thing, because that was a big part of the individual mandate, they're afraid to vote for something that does away with that. But the reason that that's important to understand, and the reason that that's important to get rid of, is it breaks the entire insurance model. Let me explain this with something that's a little less touchy than healthcare. We're all aware of homeowners insurance. You buy insurance in case something really bad happens to your home. And if for whatever reason, whether there's a flood or a fire or whatever it is, that insurance helps cover your losses for that. So you're paying into a system, getting nothing back for it. You're essentially paying for risk management. So in the off chance that something terrible happens to your house, the insurance company takes their profits from all the other homeowners that didn't have anything bad happen to their house and give you some of that money to pay you back. So you're, you know, that risk is covered for you. So in a sense, insurance, the entire industry, is like a gamble, and health insurance is really no different. The problem with saying nobody with pre-existing conditions can be turned away is that it's essentially saying you can buy homeowners insurance after your house is on fire. So your house is on fire, you make a phone call to whatever insurance company would provide you, and you buy a policy knowing that your house is going to be on fire. Well, there's two problems with that. A, you've paid nothing into the system. And B, you're going to get a whole lot out of it because you're one of the people that had their house burned down. So you're just essentially taking money from an insurance company. that's not a sustainable business model, and that's not how insurance works. That's not insurance. That's just taking money from people. But with the pre-existing condition clause that was included in Obamacare, that was the big problem with that. What people can do is, now, granted, I'm trying to be as sensitive to this as possible because I know a lot of you, including, you know, me, have had family members, loved ones that have been hit by this. But that's like purchasing health insurance after you know you have cancer. That doesn't make it insurance. That's just taking money from people because you know you're going to be paying less into it than you're getting back out of it. That's what makes it insurance. That's the purpose of insurance. So the way an insurance model, business model works is all the healthy people that don't have cancer are paying for the one guy that does. And so you're in a risk pool is what they call it. And that's really the big problem that we're running into here is that with this new bill, the pre-existing conditions being included, that's the reason the Freedom Caucus wants to get rid of that because it allows the healthcare companies to, you know, quote unquote, discriminate, which, by the way, discriminate is just another word for discretion. So discrimination is not always bad. If a guy shows up to your house at 3 a.m. wearing a hockey mask and carrying a chainsaw, I pray that you'll be smart enough to discriminate against letting him in your house. But anyway, when we're looking at the pre-existing conditions things, that's essentially what this new bill does, and that's why the Freedom Caucus is supporting it, because it allows the insurance company to be insurance companies again. The moderates are afraid of it because they know that on the onset it looks bad and it will be viewed as unpopular. But the way that you had to couple that proviso with everybody having health insurance. And so the individual mandate had to be linked to that because otherwise then just anybody can buy insurance at any time. And that's the problem that we're running into with the healthcare industry as a whole. However, and this is an important factor to bring in, the Freedom Caucus did add a proviso in there that essentially allows states to be the master of their own choices. So the individual mandate, you can get rid of it. You can choose to not have it in your state to where you have to have insurance and couple that with that you don't have to have a state where every single person, you can't discriminate because of pre-existing conditions. But that's an option, which is perfectly fine with me. If the state of California wants to destroy their own healthcare industry by allowing people with pre-existing conditions to get insurance at any given time, that's their business. I'm not a Californian, so that's up to them. I would hope that our home state, and I think that it probably will not require insurance companies to do that. But we're looking at these two things. Giving people options at the state level, giving citizens of their own state the ability to choose, and if this is something that's terribly important to them, vote with their own feet, to move wherever the system works best for them. That's the option, and that's the model that our founders had in mind. That's the point of federalism, that you have the option to do in your state essentially what you want to. So I really like this plan. If the liberal states want to do that, that's fine. If the conservative states want to not require that, that's okay too. So interesting discussion to have here. I want to hear what you have to say about it, what your thoughts are on it. Should they support it? Should they not? Should this go away? 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. We got a couple lines open, and I am going straight to the phones after talking to you real quick about the Prattville Patriots. The number one ranked Patriots beat the Pensacola Jets 50-6 in an away game last Saturday. This week, they take on the Atlanta Tigers at Stanley Jensen Stadium in Prattville. Admission is just $10. Kids under 5 get in free. There will be concessions, halftime games, pregame, meet the players events, kids zone, and more. So pregame festivities kick off at 4, and kickoff is at 6. So be sure to check that out. Let's go to Jay on line one. Good morning, Jay.
Hey, good morning, Coach Taylor.
Hey, what's on your mind, Jay?
Am I on with you?
Yeah, that's you.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say that Kef is really a lottery. It's a gamble for everybody.
Right.
The insurance companies are not going to lose money.
No, they have to stay in business. So, yeah.
People dry. If you have an individual mandate, that means that everybody at some point will be covered, so their risk will be down.
Well, there's a couple problems with the individual mandate. The first one with that, Jay, is that your risk, quote unquote, will be down from being covered. But there is a difference in receiving coverage and care. You can be covered in a lot of the countries that have socialized medicine, for example, Canada, Britain, but there will be people that are waiting for 6 to 8 months for coverage, or sorry, for health care. That even happens in our own country with the VA. And so you've got problems like that that come with the individual mandate. The individual mandate means everyone has insurance, but it doesn't mean everybody has care. And furthermore, when you're talking about the insurance companies will make money, yes, they're a business. That's their job. If they cease to make money, they can't cover anybody because they have to employ people. They have to be able to offer coverage. And so they have to make money at some point.
Hello?
I think, Jay, you there? I think we lost Jay.
Hello?
All right. Well,
he's there, but I think he needs some help.
I don't think he can hear us. All right.
No,
thank
I can't hear you. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Yeah, go ahead.
Taylor.
I don't think he can hear us. I'm sorry, Jay. I got to let you go.
Yeah, that's a lot of background.
I don't think he can hear us. But anyway, that's the problem that you run into with the individual mandate is just because everyone has quote unquote insurance, it doesn't mean everybody has care. And the problem with everybody having care is that you wind up rationing it if there's no profit incentive. Now, we can all talk about those evil, greedy insurance companies if you want to. And I'm not trying to make a defense for them. I'm sure that they make mistakes and there are underhanded people in that business, just like there are underhanded people in every business. There's underhanded people in the radio business. So when you're comparing that, yes, there's going to be some corruption in this industry, just like every other industry. But you can't say that just because health insurance companies are trying to make a profit that they're all bad. They have to make a profit or else nobody gets covered. And so insurance companies provide a useful and very much needed service to people. All right. So that being said, that's really all the news we have now. There's not a whole lot more to cover because this is a very new story. We're going to look into it. The projection now is that they're going to drop back and punt and look at some of the things that they can do with the healthcare bill. They may try to bring it to a vote next week. Their goal was to get it done within the first 100 days because, again, the media is making a big deal about the first 100 days because Donald Trump is making a big deal about the first 100 days. I think if he had shut up about it, they probably would have left him alone a little bit more on that. But looking into all this, that's one of the reasons that Trump really wanted to push this through. You know, it's a complex issue, and I think that it takes a little more time, a little more planning. And that's why we're going to be looking into this. It's an incredibly important issue. A lot of the people that are in Washington right now ran on repealing Obamacare. Even this plan doesn't really do that. They're at least being honest with the American people about it. I'll give them credit for that. But when we're looking at this, we will keep an eye on it and keep you updated on that. I did want to mention something real quick, and we'll get into this just a little bit before we go to the break. I've been paying a lot of attention over the past week to everything that was going on at Berkeley. For those of you who don't know, at Berkeley, protests broke out, which caused Ann Coulter, who's a conservative speaker, relatively. I won't get into the nuances of that. But she was supposed to be speaking at Berkeley, and the Berkeley students and other people came and protested, wound up getting her speech canceled, and then they're trying to reschedule, but it's been a problem because the protesters are saying they're going to do the same thing whenever she's scheduled to come back again. We had street fights breaking out between Ann Coulter protesters and Ann Coulter supporters. And you had pro-Trump people just showing up, and conflicts ensued, as you can imagine. Unfortunately, this is becoming an all-too-common story. And this, to me, is really the big problem with shutting down free speech. Because what happens is, if you let people actually cancel speakers, if you actually have people not speak because protesters and security concerns and whatnot, I understand all those considerations. But at the same time, you gave them an inch, and now they're going to take a mile. Because you have people on the alt-right, the fringe wing of, you know, they're not conservatives, they're just right-wing. There's a difference there. They're part of the nationalist, sort of the European right-wing version of European nationalism. And you've got guys like Milo, like Richard Spencer, who spoke at Auburn. We talked about that at length last week on the program. They're shutting those people down, which was bad enough because they allowed their opinions and to speak freely as well. But see, now what's happening is they're shutting down even mainstream conservative speakers like Ann Coulter. Now, I've never been a huge fan of Ann Coulter, even back in the day when I was considered myself more Republican than conservative. Even back then, I never really liked Ann Coulter. I don't like her style. I don't necessarily agree with a lot of the things that she says. But at the same time, Ann Coulter has a right to speak. And she is considered one of the more mainstream conservative voices. She's not Milo. She's not Richard Spencer. She's not a radical. She is a little too authoritarian for my taste. But the point is, canceling a speech by her is tantamount to canceling a speech by a guy like, oh, Sean Hannity or Rudy Giuliani or Bill O'Reilly, one of those guys. And so what's happened is they've learned that they can shut down speech that they don't like when it's somebody super extreme like Milo or Richard Spencer. And now what they're trying to do is they're trying to shut down any voices they don't like, which is what I predicted, if you'll recall. And that's the problem with allowing people to shut down free speech, is because when they start shutting down the extreme voices, the next thing they're going to do is go after all the voices they disagree with. And that's exactly what's happening here. So we'll talk more about this when we come back. Take it away, Rush.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
A watchful eye must be kept on ourselves, lest, while we're building ideal monuments of renown and bliss here, we neglect to have our names enrolled in the annals of heaven. James Madison.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, as always, are the numbers. Now, we are going to get back into our subject matter, talking about what was going on with Berkeley and the protests, but I got to mention this because I just found this. I was on Twitter during the break, and I got to bring this up because for those of you who have been listening to the program, you know I'm a huge, huge comic book geek. And apparently today is National Superhero Day.
Mm-hmm. So, where's your shirt?
Well, see, that's the thing. I didn't know. And Joe will tell you about half the time I'm in here with a different superhero shirt on. Today I'm actually wearing Boston, the band. Mm-hmm. So I don't have one on today, but I got to go with, because they were asking on there who your favorite superhero is. I got to go with Superman. Always been my favorite. It's a classic. He was the first superhero. I just love his character. I've been reading Superman comics since I was a little kid, so I'm going to have to go with Superman as my favorite, with Spider-Man at a close second.
Oh, what about Batman?
Batman would probably break my top five, but honestly, I'm not as obsessed with Batman as a lot of people are.
I really don't see how anybody cannot like Superman. Well, of course, maybe the arch villain.
I was about to say, Batman doesn't like Superman, so they had a whole movie about that.
But it's interesting. I don't know if I ought to mention satellite radio, but heck, everybody knows it exists. There's a channel, Classic Radio, and every once in a while they air original radio Superman versions,
okay,
with Bud Collier as Superman. And of course it's up and away, up, and when he flies, they have, I'm flying. I mean, it's no visual.
Well, you have no vision. That's the problem that we have with radio, but It's like, actually, a lot of people who don't know this, I do a little voice acting in my spare time. It helps with having this. And granted, I'm still not fully recovered from my sickness, but I'll try to do a Superman impersonation here real quick. It's like, greetings, citizens. I'm Superman. So if you go check out my YouTube channel at Patriot Preacher, you can actually see my impersonation of both him and Batman. I did a little video there with the two of them in a presidential debate.
Well,
so be sure to go and check that out. That's
I will the
Batman versus Superman debate on YouTube. But anyway, getting back into what we were talking about, just wanted to do that just for fun. With everything that was going on with Berkeley and Coulter, you have to keep in mind that when Ann Coulter was essentially canceled from speaking at Berkeley, it was a result of people, the group that they claim, because I think this eventually hurts liberals, honestly. I think that being seen as bullies that can't stand to hear any speech they disagree with. You ever seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Joe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know
more
that,
than once.
You know that scene where you have the Knights of Knee? Who they have the word that they can't hear, and every time someone says the word, they cover their ears and go, ah! I think that that's in a lot of ways what a lot of liberals, like the younger liberals especially, are kind of like nowadays. They hear something they can't hear, and they just cover their ears and start shouting. That's kind of the visual that drums up in my
hear
head
no
when
evil.
I hear this. Right? But I think in the long run, this actually does hurt liberals, because what they've done is you're not going to get rid of the extreme guys. So Richard Spencer, Milo Yiannopoulos, or whatever his name is, and Alex Jones, guys like that, you're not going to get rid of those guys. They're always going to be around. There's always been fringes of each party, and they have cult-like followers, so their movement never really goes away. Now, it's always a minority, but they never really go away. But here's the problem. The people that can be shut down are the people that have reasonable people listen to them. Guys like Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, those kind of guys. When you shut down those guys, the guys that are actually reasonable people, and you discredit them, the only people you're left with are the extremists. I mean, Bill O'Reilly's as moderate a Republican as you can get. And I know that there are people that wouldn't perceive it that way, but believe me, he's not some kind of uber-conservative activist, never has been. He's very down the middle. Center right, maybe, but definitely not a conservative, and never called himself a conservative. So when we're looking at this, unfortunately, I think what you're doing is you're going to have people following Steve Bannon and Alex Jones and Milo, because those are the only conservative voices that you have left when you try to force out the reasonable people. And what's interesting to me is that this movement, for those of you who are unaware of this, they refer to themselves as the anti-fascist group, which, if you know your history, they're trying to do a callback to the people that the black shirts that were opposing the Nazis back when Nazism was first getting kicked off. And the anti-fascist movement, interestingly enough, is the one that's shutting down free speech. Now, what is the definition of a fascist? This is coming from dictionary.com. A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism. So if you're forcibly suppressing your opposition and those who are critical of you, doesn't that technically make you a fascist?
Mm-hmm.
It's just something to consider. Because if you're going to claim to be anti-fascist, if you're going to claim to be against the shutting down of opposition, then you probably shouldn't be shutting down your opposition. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to keep people from speaking. Now, protesting is one thing, but when the stated goal of your protest is to have someone not be able to speak, like if they just stood outside, picketed, and voiced their opposition to Ann Coulter's message, that would be one thing, but they're not doing that. They're actively trying to cause trouble to where there is a security risk to where she cannot speak. And that's the stated goal of their protest. So you're actually, by doing that, making yourself closer to a fascist than Ann Coulter ever thought about being. And I think it's an important conversation to have. Now, liberals have become, a lot of them, openly hostile towards free speech that they disapprove of. And just to kind of give some credence to what I'm talking about, Howard Dean. A lot of you may remember Howard Dean as becoming famous for that rant that he went on, and it was in the primary where Kerry was eventually nominated as the Democrat nominee in that election. Howard Dean, at one of his meetings, started yelling out the names of different states. It was like, and we're going to Delaware and Colorado and California. And just, it was a great piece of television comedy. But that eventually wound up killing his campaign. So this is a guy who was almost the Democrat nominee, and he was the chairman of the DNC for a while, too. This is a very mainstream, part of the party, team player Democrat. And on this whole issue, he tweeted out the other day, hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment. Yeah, it is. It's speech. All speech is protected by the First Amendment. That's what free speech means.
Yeah, actually it does.
You're allowed to say anything, even if it's hateful, even if it's not necessarily the best thing to say, the smartest thing to say. You're allowed to have that opinion. You're allowed to voice that speech. Look, we can't start prosecuting hatred. Now, and this is one of the big problems that I have with hate crimes. Isn't all crime hate crimes? If you kill somebody, that's a hate crime.
That is, but not, I mean, not all. If you encompass all crimes, I mean, if you go in and steal a six pack from a Stop and Rob, so to speak, that's not really a hate crime.
But No, it's not.
Like a crime of violence where you actually harm someone intentionally, yeah, that's pretty much hate.
A crime of violence would, now, if we're going by the biblical definition, and I'm trying not to get way off on this this rabbit trail, but if you're going by the biblical definition, hatred is merely a lack of love. And really any crime would technically be a hate crime, according to that definition.
Yeah, because if you really loved someone, you wouldn't steal from them. You wouldn't do anything that's going to harm them anyway.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so, or take advantage of someone. So, yeah, if you're going by the biblical definition, now the legal definition, of course, is different. But going back to what Howard Deed was saying, free speech is protected by the First Amendment. In fact, that's why the First Amendment was put in place, specifically to protect speech that was going to be controversial.
Yeah, you don't have to protect if someone is saying something you like and you embrace. That doesn't really need any protection.
Right, exactly. Speech that everybody agrees with, there's no reason to protect that. And here's the problem with making hate speech, quote-unquote, prosecuting that. What constitutes hate speech is so incredibly subjective and so dependent upon the hearer, not the intent of the speaker, because you can't know a person's heart, you can't know what they intended when they said something, that anything that is a perceived slight to most of the left is now hatred in their minds. We've all been in conversations with people, and I'm sure there's people on the right that are like this too, just with different issues. But when you're talking to someone on the left, just about anything you say can be perceived as hatred. For example, I'm a fiscal conservative, which means I always support, with a handful of rare exceptions, the minimum amount of spending humanly possible. That's why I'm against welfare programs. And because I'm against welfare programs, I've been accused of hating black people, because black people receive a lot of welfare programs. First of all, I said, well, that's a little racist to say that black people need welfare programs specifically. Why wouldn't all poor people need them? But secondly, when we're talking about that, just about anything qualifies for hatred in their minds. And because it is subjective, and because you could twist almost anything to say, well, it's hate speech, then once you say hate speech is no longer protected by the First Amendment, then you can make almost any speech you disagree with, you could make the case that it is also hate speech. And so that's why we have to be very careful with what we're talking about, and that's why there should be no deviation from the idea that you're allowed to speak your mind, you're allowed to speak freely, even if it winds up being controversial or hateful. So we're going to talk a little bit more about this. Of course, there was some media fallout that I want to get to on this. Stick around. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. My will defy a little bit of gravity.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Christian religion is, above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. John Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. I have resorted back to cough drops because my throat was just giving out of me. You could probably tell I was fighting it in the last part of that last segment. But I'm back, and hopefully we can kind of forego that.
You
hopefully
need your own cough button.
Yeah, we really do. You know, Longshore gets one. We don't get one.
He also gets a cool studio.
Yeah, well, you know.
So I guess.
The grass is always greener on the other side.
Longevity has its privileges or something.
I suppose so. But anyway, so getting back to what we're talking about with the liberals basically defending getting rid of free speech like Howard Dean in the wake of what was going on with Ann Coulter, it's bothersome to me because what constitutes hate speech is incredibly subjective, and pretty much any slight, anything that is deemed offensive by them constitutes hate in their mind, and unfortunately to them, that's no different than physical harm. And I could go through this case by case. We've done it many times. But what bothers me is they're treating me saying something offensive, for example, as if I punched them in the face. And it's not the same thing. There is a difference in your words and your actions. But anyway, I wanted to bring this up real quickly. There was a segment on Tucker Carlson where he had a professor named Aaron Hallen on where he said that in his speech, essentially defending colleges and universities just wholesale saying certain people are banished from speaking on their campus. And he said, well, this is not an argument about whether or not I agree with them. It's an argument about the quality of the speaker and what they bring to the community of that university. But here's the thing. Could not name a single liberal that he thinks should be banned. So apparently there are several conservatives he thinks that shouldn't be allowed to speak. But when it comes to liberals, well, they should just all be allowed. So it's, quote unquote, not about me disagreeing with them, but only people he disagrees with are the ones banned. And at the same time, he said that speakers and students are actually at fault for being deliberately provocative. So whether it's the College Republicans or the Young Americans for Liberty or whoever it is that invites the speaker, and the speaker itself, it's the speaker's fault and it's those organizations' fault for being provocative. But the whole point of certain debate tactics is to be provocative. Now, I tend to try to be as not provocative as possible because I think that it helps my message. And I know that that's a style choice. That's not necessarily a difference in beliefs. But my point in all of that is if you essentially ban provocative speech, then that does get to the point where people are only allowed to say things that the general population agrees with. And so they are censoring free speech by not allowing people that are, quote, deliberately provocative. I was a debater for a long time. I was a national debate champion. And so when you're talking about debate, sometimes your debates are intentionally over the top, ridiculous, and provocative. I actually won a debate one time doing that because I used an extreme example to prove my point. And so good debate, rigorous debate that makes you think usually is provocative. And so them shutting down speech because it's quote-unquote provocative is, in my mind, is a big disservice to the academic community. And furthermore, he's essentially blaming the people for being attacked like this. You're blaming the victim. Because, and I'm going to put this in terms the liberal will understand, I'm not advocating for this, I'm just using the example. Again, I'm being deliberately provocative to make my point. Would it be okay if a woman is dressed provocatively for her to be sexually assaulted? No, of course not. That's ridiculous and no one would agree with that. But you see what I'm saying here. The speakers and the student organizations being quote-unquote deliberately provocative, according to this professor, that does not justify having them shut down. That does not justify violence in the streets because they're provocative. You don't blame them. You blame the people that take it to the next level and want to be violent because they heard something they were offended by. You don't blame the victim of censorship. You blame the people doing the censoring. So just one thought, but I will say this, and I do want to give credit where credit is due, because not all liberals think this way. There was a time where just about everybody, liberal, conservative, didn't matter who you are or what party you belong to, We all defended free speech unconditionally. There was no negotiation, and it wasn't that long ago. I can remember this in my younger days where it wasn't even really considered to shut people down because of what they were saying, even if what they were saying was terrible. Unfortunately, a lot of liberals have abandoned this, but there are some that still hold to that principle. One of the organizations that I've got to get a pat on the back to, and I rarely get to do this, the ACLU came out in strong support of Ann Coulter and her right to speak freely and speak her mind. And they said that it was a heckler's veto, essentially saying just because people in the crowd don't like it, she's being shut down. And they said even hateful speech must be defended. So I want to say kudos to the ACLU.
Oh, yeah.
We're usually on the opposite sides of the debate, but on this, me and the ACLU are in agreement.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and it's they're not the only ones. This is a statement by Senator Bernie Sanders in an interview. I don't like, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and do the Bernie voice. I don't like this. I don't like it. Obviously, Ann Coulter is outrageous, to my mind, off the wall. But, you know, people have a right to give their 2 cents worth. Give a speech without fear of violence and intimidation. So, Bernie Sanders and I are actually in agreement on this. The guy who's a self-proclaimed socialist and I agree that you don't have people just shut you down because of what you're saying. He was saying that he doesn't like Ann Coulter. He thinks she's off the wall. He thinks that she's wrong. But people have a right to give their 2 cents worth, to give free speech. And they can do it, according to Bernie Sanders, without the fear of violence or intimidation. So a lot of these young liberals who probably would have voted for Bernie Sanders, this is why I think that it's important that it was Bernie Sanders saying it. And Bill Maher actually brought this up, too. He said, Berkeley used to be the cradle of free speech. Now it's just a cradle for, words I can't say, babies. And I feel like this is the liberal version of book burning. Now, I want you to think about this and think about what this implies. I'm an uber-conservative, like, 1976 kind of guy. When I agree with the ACLU, Bernie Sanders, and Bill Maher more than I agree with Howard Dean, we are out of step with the general populace of the DNC. Something to think about. Hour 2 coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
Hey, gang, it's Friday, and you know what that means. It's time for the new Top 10. Welcome back, everybody. Hour 2 of The Patriot Preacher is on now, and we're going to get you set up for the weekend, get it started out right by going ahead and giving you the new top 10. Before we do that, I did want to mention really quickly that you can score big with our latest sweet deal for the Yellow Hammer Cafe. You can get 5 $10 gift certificates for just $25. That's right, $50 worth of food for $25. Enjoy our breakfast or lunch at the Yellow Hammer Cafe and save 50% with this super sweet deal. That's on sale right now at newsradio1440.com. Now, I don't know if there are any left because it went on sale at 8 a.m. We should be able to check that out. Hopefully, we do have some of those gift certificates left. And, you know, they usually last about 4 or 5 hours afterwards. So you should be in the clear. Check it out, newsradio1440.com. Be sure to look at that. And keep in mind that we had the owner there the other day, and it was we had a lot of fun with it. So, all right. The new top 10 this week is the top 10 things Obama won't be doing during his retirement.
All right. Wow.
All right, party on. Now, the top 10 things Obama won't be doing during his retirement. Number 10, playing golf with Rush Limbaugh. Number 9, fundraising for the Heritage Foundation. Number 8, movie nights with Benjamin Netanyahu. Number 7, wearing men's jeans. Number 6, giving Donald Trump career advice.
Yeah, no.
Probably not. Number 5, teaching classes on the Constitution.
Mm.
Number 4, reading Dave Ramsey books.
What?
Dave Ramsey, The Economist.
I know.
Yeah. Don't think you'll be reading many of those.
Oh, books.
Books, yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Number three, shirtless horseback riding.
Yep, no.
Like old Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
Number two, balancing his own checkbook. And the number one thing that Obama will not be doing during his retirement. Minding his own business.
Oh!
So, just a little primer. That is the top 10 things Obama will not be doing during his retirement. All right.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with next week's top 10. Did want to mention before we go to a break, though, my good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, I've been with them for the 2 years that I've been back in the Montgomery area. Of course, when I moved from Auburn, I had a great mechanic in Auburn. Really loved him, trusted him. I actually went to church with, in fact, he was an elder, the guy who ran the, it's Grady's Tire and Auto up in Opelika. Free plug for them if you happen to be listening from there. And I really trusted him, really liked them, appreciated everything they did for me. And I love, that's one of the first things I'm worried about when I move to a new town is finding a good mechanic. And I'm really glad that I found Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, because I was hoping to find somebody that was as good or better than the mechanics I had in Auburn. And I say they meet the test on every single standing. Love these guys. They know what they're doing. And I trust them with my truck, which is important, because if something happens in my truck, I can't come in every day to speak to you good people. So you could say that the Patriot Preacher is powered by Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Got brand new tires on my truck, courtesy of them. Oil changes, anything that I need, big or small, that can be done with my truck, I go to them, and that's exactly what you should do. Anything goes wrong with your car, you need a tune-up, need to check things out before you're going on a trip, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center on the Troy Highway, been in business 50 years for a good reason. Check them out today in the south side of Montgomery. That is Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We'll be back.
You come and go.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 28:19-20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440. And the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. This, to me, was a big story that kind of got glossed over. And the reason that I believe it's important is because, especially with what's going on with America right now, both sides of the aisle, really, have lost a lot of faith in our intelligence agencies. And that's a real shame, because they're definitely not above reproach. They're definitely not, you know, saints and could do no wrong or anything like that. But the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, to a lesser extent the NSA, a lot of them are dedicated civil servants that are just trying to do their work and really don't care much about politics. Some of them do, obviously, and some of them are political animals. But to a large part, I think that a lot of them are really just trying to do their job and do it separate and apart from politics. So this new report came out that gives us a great deal of insight, and by the way, hat tip to the New York Times for publishing all this information. Very lengthy article, but a lot of really solid information in it. They came out with this new report that shows that Comey actually, you'll remember James Comey, the head of the FBI, he adopted that go-it-alone approach when it came to the Hillary Clinton debacle and everything that was going on with her emails. Of course, one thing that is interesting about James Comey is both parties keep constantly switching back and forth as to whether he's a hero or a villain, which, by the way, to me is all the evidence I need that he's probably one of the few men in Washington actually doing his job, because nobody can decide whether they love him or hate him. So I think that he's been doing really well up there so far as I can tell, and really reading this report just confirmed a lot of those suspicions that I had. Now, why would he choose to go it alone? Why would he, after everything that happened, choose to kind of make himself an island and not necessarily defy the orders of his boss, Loretta Lynch, but not necessarily heed her advice on several things and really act almost independently of her in a lot of ways. According to this new report, a lot of that had to do with the fact that James Comey was thoroughly convinced that Loretta Lynch had been compromised. Because this new information has come out that during the election, Loretta Lynch had actually been offering political cover to Hillary Clinton. Now, this is something that conservatives had been suspicious of and talked about quite a bit during the election. But some of the new details after this have come to light. For example, and there's quite a bit of evidence to back this up. The day after Clinton's criminal referral, Lynch and the DOJ retracted the word criminal from every single instance that it was used in. So they came out, it was a criminal referral. Basically what a criminal referral is it's not exactly a warrant. It's a recommendation to the Justice Department to say there is a suspicion of criminal activity here. So it's similar to a warrant in that sense. And we believe that it merits investigation. And so after receiving that referral and putting that forward, which kind of jump-started the investigation, Loretta Lynch came out, and this is not something that's done very commonly. I don't know if it's ever been done, to be perfectly honest, came out and removed the word criminal from the press releases and all their documentation. So it was just, it wasn't a criminal referral anymore. It was just a referral of an investigation. Which, by the way, Hillary Clinton used to her advantage, because you'll recall many times on the campaign trail, she said, well, it's not a criminal investigation. Well, it was a criminal investigation. The only reason that it wasn't considered a criminal investigation is because the Department of Justice, which was headed up by Attorney General Lynch, had removed all references to criminal activity. It was still the same thing. The activity, the charges were the same. They just took the word criminal out of it. They're playing semantics with the official reports, which to me would have been an automatic nod to why Lynch was not appropriate to be in charge of that, and she should have recused herself from all matters regarding Hillary Clinton in my mind. But that seems to be one of the reasons that Comey opted to kind of go his own way when it came to this investigation. And also, it's important to keep in mind to understand the context and all of this is going on, that Loretta Lynch, during all these talks with the FBI and the other agencies, when she brought this to the FBI and said, strictly, this is not an investigation and you guys are not supposed to use the word investigation. You're supposed to refer to it as a matter, which, by the way, I thought cleverly, one of the staffers said, so are we the Federal Bureau of Matters now? That anyway... when they did this investigation, it was Loretta Lynch that said, you're not supposed to call it an investigation, you're supposed to call it a matter. And keep in mind, this is before that they did eventually confirm it was an investigation, but Loretta Lynch, seemingly for as long as she could, kept it from being called an investigation. These are according to official documents that were released in this report from the FBI. Clinton also claimed that it was not a criminal investigation, and the FBI had found hacked documents where the AD&C operative said that Lynch would keep the investigation from going too far. Now, this is not evidence of collusion, and I do not want to make the case that it was, because we don't know for a fact that the DNC was working with Lynch. However, based on this email that they found, when you remember when a lot of the DNC emails, after they had been hacked, when the FBI found some of these, when the FBI found that hacked document, and the DNC operative in an email is saying that Lynch would keep the investigation from going too far, it seemed that they were doing so with some kind of inside information and with a great deal of confidence. Now, we don't know a ton of the details on this because it's been redacted to protect some identities. But at the same time, this is apparently a very big player in the Democrats' party. This is somebody who would have known what was going on, and it seems that they were confident they had some kind of information that let them know that Loretta Lynch was on their side, that Loretta Lynch was going to keep this investigation from hurting Hillary Clinton's bid to the White House. That should be terrifying to any of you, because it suggests, again, it's not proof, but it suggests that there were people at the DNC that knew exactly how Loretta Lynch was going to react to this, because they knew the kind of person that she was, and according to this email, it hints at they actually knew this because they had been in contact with her. Again, we don't know that. This is speculation. But the circumstantial evidence looks pretty bad here. Furthermore, you have just right before the investigation was closed. Now, keep in mind, it did reopen. But when it closed the first time and James Comey went before everybody, all the TV cameras were on him, and he announced that they were not announcing charges. Just 3 days before that happened, there was a secret meeting between Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton that was picked up by a local news organization, a local news channel there. And they happened to meet on the tarmac. According to their version of the story, it was just happenstance, and Loretta Lynch wanted to come by and say hi. But here's the thing. You're the Attorney General of the United States, and you're aware that the biggest issue for the Department of Justice that's going on right now is that the FBI is investigating Hillary Clinton, the wife of the former president. Either there was something under the table going on here, or Loretta Lynch is the stupidest attorney general in recorded history for seeking out a conversation with the husband of the woman that she is investigating and the whole country is watching. So it seems to be, and here's another thing that was interesting. There was nobody privy to that conversation. They made sure that security and everybody else was out of the area when they met on the airplane to have a conversation, which lasted roughly 20 minutes. And then just 3 days later, the FBI, which you are in charge of, says that they're not recommending charges. That stinks to high heaven. There is so many reasons to believe that something was going on in that plane. And unfortunately, we'll never know because the only two people that were there were Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton. But you're looking at the results of it and what exactly happened. There's no question in my mind that something was going on that plane. I don't know if a deal was struck or what, but the fact that just 3 days later, no charges were recommended, there's something going on with that. Also, the Democrats are upset because now we know about the Trump investigation. So this is what they're going to use to counter all these talking points. We know that Donald Trump was also under investigation by the FBI for collusion with the Russians. Now, not Donald Trump himself. Nobody has insinuated that. When we talked to Comey, I guess that press conference was about 2-3 weeks ago. They were asking him about that investigation. He never said or even insinuated that Donald Trump himself was under investigation. He said that the Trump campaign was under investigation, and there is a small but important difference. Because that means that there were people within the campaign that had ties to Russia that they were looking at. That's technically not new information. We know that. In fact, we reported it right here on the Patriot Preacher back when I had the Saturday show about everything that was going on with General Flynn, Paul Manafort, Stephen K. Bannon. There are people with eerily strong ties to Russia. But the Democrats are going to make that case and say, well, why was James Comey, if he's so unbiased and so above it all, why did he tell us about what was going on with the Clinton investigation, especially when he brought out that it had been reopened just a couple weeks before the election, and he didn't tell us about the Trump investigation? Well, here's the problem with that theory. Comey made it a point to finish the investigation way before the election to keep it from being as much of an issue. We actually have this from his correspondence. We know that he and the rest of the FBI were trying to finish as quickly as possible so that it wouldn't affect the election at least more than it was supposed to, which is why they finished and announced that before the primary was even over. She wasn't even the nominee when they concluded this investigation. Furthermore, he made his case. He gave scathing evidence that he said in any other investigation, in any other circumstance, if you were not Hillary Clinton, you would have been in a lot of trouble for this. Made that case, made it to the American people, gave the evidence that they had gathered, and then didn't recommend charges. So he did want to put the facts out there, let the people know, hey, this is what she did, and then leave it to the American people to decide, which I thought was the right course of action. He announced it. The Hillary investigation was closed at that point. But here's the thing. You're allowed to comment on an investigation that has been closed. You are not supposed to comment on an investigation that is ongoing. And up until, well, actually, it may still be ongoing. We don't know because they didn't confirm that. But when that was going on, the Trump investigation was open. It was ongoing. Hillary Clinton's case was closed, which is why he commented on it the way that he did. Now, when it reopened, that was because he promised Congress and told them, if something new happens with this, I will alert you. It was not James Comey's fault. Actually, it's Anthony Weiner's fault. It is not James Comey's fault that they found new evidence just a couple weeks before the election. He can't control when intel comes in. But he did promise Congress that that's what was going to happen. And so what happened is that he was essentially caught between a rock and a hard place. And that's something that I do not envy from being James Comey, because when that information comes in about 2 or 3 weeks before the election starts, he's got to make a decision. Okay, what I can do here is I can not alert the American people, not alert Congress, and then after the election be accused of keeping information from the voter when this information could lead to a large-scale criminal investigation. We may be investigating the new president-elect of the United States. Or I can go ahead and tell them, give the voters the information, let them decide for themselves, try to get the investigation done as soon as possible before the election, and let the chips fall where they may. When you're stuck in a situation like that, James Comey opted for transparency, which, in my opinion, was the right thing to do. Now, that's my opinion, and the way it played out, I think that that confirms that my opinion was correct. But I understand why people feel slighted on that, but he was stuck in a no-win situation. He was going to be accused of partiality, regardless of which way he came out on it. So, when you're stuck in a no-win situation like that, in my opinion, you always opt for transparency, and that's exactly what he did. So, I know that there are a lot of you who are Trump voters, have some pretty strong opinions on this. Call in 860-1440 or the numbers if you want to talk about this, talk about what happened with Trump, what happened with Clinton. Would this have changed, if you're a Clinton voter, would this have changed how you voted for, did it change how you voted, whether it was for Clinton or somebody else? I want to know about these things. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call, weigh in on this Friday. Now, we were talking beforehand about James Comey and this new report that's come out that explained some of his actions, helped shed some light, really, on what he was doing, the reason he was making the decisions that he did. And I think that I've laid out a pretty strong case for why he believed Loretta Lynch was compromised, why he was stuck in a no-win situation, and he had to kind of do his own thing because he was afraid that his boss, the Attorney General of the United States, was providing political cover for Hillary Clinton. And there's a pretty strong case to be made there that that's exactly what she was doing. And so he's trying to protect the FBI. He's trying to ensure that the American people feel as though they're impartial and that they're not trying to get into politics. And that's why he made the decisions the way that he did. So it's important to understand all that lead up. But now we're getting into the decision that he actually made. The reason that this investigation was opened once again is because of a person named Huma Abedin. Huma Abedin was one of Hillary Clinton's top advisors during the campaign, and she was married to Anthony Weiner. Now, Anthony Weiner had all of a sudden come under investigation for with the FBI for child pornography and charges of having a relationship with, because what happened is, and what drummed up the suspicion, by the way, again, because Anthony Weiner just doesn't seem to be able to keep himself in check when it comes to this stuff. He's been called up on investigation for this multiple times, never with a minor before, though. Now it looks as though he might actually have done something illegal as well as stupid. So in the past, it was just stupid. Now it's stupid and illegal. And he was having a text conversation, which included pictures of his anatomy. I'll just leave it at that, with,
please.
Yes. Well, his name says it all, doesn't it, Joe? But anyway.
where's that drum roll?
Yeah, no, that's good. Give me a rim shot if you find it.
I need a rim shot.
Yeah. But anyway. So Anthony Weiner was having this text conversation where there were pictures exchanged of his stuff and with a 15-year-old girl. And because of this, for obvious reasons, they launched an investigation into Anthony Weiner. And part of that investigation was confiscating his laptop. Well, on his laptop, during this investigation, they found emails to and from his wife because, you know, they're married, it's her laptop too. And there are a lot of email correspondence between Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton. Before Hillary Clinton turned in her emails, there's a mysterious segment that are missing. About, 30,000 government emails that belong and are the property of the U.S. government that she had on her private server and then just deleted. And it was interesting because that was the time period right around the time the Benghazi scandal was happening. And so the most significant, most important emails in the entire server, Hillary Clinton just decided, yeah, I'm going to delete those before I turn those in. Now, of course, her excuse was, well, those were just personal emails and they had nothing to do with my official capacity as the Secretary of State, which I really like how Hillary Clinton made herself the judge and juror when it came to making that decision instead of just turning it over to them and letting them look through it. If you didn't want your personal emails looked through, then maybe you shouldn't have had a secret server in your basement. But anyway, not to sidetrack on that. So they found these emails of Huma Abedin through Anthony Weiner. And they're in this significant period of time where they don't really have any record of Hillary Clinton's emails. And so it is quite possible that this laptop has quite a few emails on it that they have been missing previously, and they could find something else with the Hillary investigation. So after about 2 or 3 days of batting it around in the offices of the FBI in the J. Edgar Hoover building, James Comey comes to the decision, okay, we're going to go public with this. I promised Congress we were going to. I don't want people, the American public, to say, well, if I had known she was under FBI investigation, I would have voted for this. Because here's the thing, and it's important to understand this in context. Everybody in the know, everybody in Washington, and everybody at the FBI thoroughly believed, and keep in mind, I believed it. It wasn't just the FBI guys. I mean, this is what I predicted, that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. And the last thing they wanted to do is to be accused of collusion. Because let's just say, because keep in mind, this is where they're coming from. This is how they're thinking about it. Let's just say Hillary Clinton wins. Hillary Clinton wins the election. Donald Trump loses. And now all of a sudden, the FBI is accused of helping her win because they kept an investigation that was reopened a secret from the American people. There would have been possibly hundreds of thousands of people saying, hey, well, I wouldn't have voted for her if I'd known she was under FBI investigation at the time. And so what they were doing there is, you could make the argument, yes, it affected the election, but James Comey went with the decision, well, it's better to come out with it now and ignore what time it is, because he can't control the timeline. He can't control when new evidence shows up on his desk. It's better for us to just go ahead, tell the American people, inform them, let them know, try to get it done as quick as possible so it won't affect the election. But he says, we got to come forward with this. We promised the American people that we would. We promised we would be transparent. And so we've got to let them know about this kind of thing. And that's exactly what they did. And keep in mind, they expected Hillary Clinton to win anyway. They expected her to win in spite of all this. And they didn't want people to say the if I had known that kind of question looming over them when Hillary Clinton was the president. So it's important to understand that's really what affected his decision to go ahead and just go ahead and tell the American people, tell Congress, let it be known. Now, granted, it looked bad. I still think that it didn't have enough of an effect to change the outcome of the election. I think it did have an effect on the election. There's polling data to back that up. And as you guys know, I followed the polling data like a hawk in this past election. But so he was stuck in a no-win situation for sure. But I think he made the right call, made the right decision, let the American people decide. And it all wound up working out to where it probably with as much as Trump won by, probably didn't affect the election anyway, the way the Electoral College shook out. But anyway, I wanted to address this for a moment because both sides have been batting back and forth on this issue. I think I've laid out the case here that why it happened and the way that it happened and the way it unfolded and the way that it did because of Loretta Lynch and her apparent collusion with the Clintons. But, you know, you've got one side now yelling, well, Trump was colluding with the Russians, Hillary was crooked, and she had the DNC and the government working against or working for her and in her pocket. Guys, I think we've been thinking about this all wrong. And I mean that. Because we're talking about the Russians affecting the election with hacking the emails and putting that out there, and then Trump being in collusion with the Russians, even though we haven't proved that yet. So this pointless debate goes back and forth. I really do think we've been thinking about it wrong this entire time. Because what this shows and what these new reports have instilled in us is that Russians are the enemies of America. Not the enemies of the Republicans, not the enemies of the Democrats. They are the enemies of America. They want America to be less powerful so they can take the stage and they can be the most powerful country in the world. And so we shouldn't think of the Russians as being friends of the Republicans or enemy of the Republicans or friends of the Democrats or enemies of the Democrats. They are the opponents of America. And probably not all of them, but if nothing else, the leadership in the Kremlin certainly is. And so we should all be united on that because we're so divided that we assume that if one side is against Russia, the other side has to be for Russia. We're all Americans. And we need to show a united front on this. Russia understands that we're divided and is seeking to play us against each other. In fact, the top foreign affairs advisor for the Kremlin, Alexander Dugin, has talked about the strategy, about specifically trying to wedge Republicans and Democrats against each other to divide America and divide our interest. So they know that they're doing this. They're doing it intentionally. We can't allow them to do that. We can disagree on policy. We can disagree on who should be in office. That's fine. That's part of our republic. But let's unite on America. Let's unite as Americans to do what's in the best interest of our country. We can't control who the president is. That fight's over and done. It's you know, it's settled, just like it was with Barack Obama. And we just kind of had to make do, even if we didn't like him. And so let's unite under that principle, because apparently it worked. Russia's done a pretty good job of dividing us, not only on them, but on other issues, too. They've undermined our faith in the intelligence community. They've undermined our faith in our electorate system, at least for part of the country. They're trying to get us to no longer have faith in our institutions, and so far it's working. Let's not give them the satisfaction. Do the best that we can to make sure everything's done fairly, honestly, in an unbiased fashion, but at the same time, keep in mind that there are people that want to see America taken down a peg. And we've got to fight that. All right. Star Spangled Sermon coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. Trying to get you ready for the weekend. I thought it was interesting. I was reading through this portion of Scripture the other day, and it's important that I set it up for you first. In Acts 2, because Acts is the history of the early church, we see the very first part of Acts, Christ's ascension, him and his last words to his followers before he leaves. And then in Acts 2, we see the first gospel sermon preached. Peter and the other apostles preaching to the people at Pentecost. And afterward, the church is developed. The Pentecost is often referred to as the church's birthday. It was the day the church was established here on earth, because it moved from being people who just were disciples of Christ following him around to an actual organization with some structure to it. And that was because you had people being preached to, baptized, obeying the gospel, and becoming members of the church. And so there were people that were starting to congregate, worship, that sort of thing. This is the very dawn of Christianity. So this is how the scripture describes that particular moment in time and the fallout to it. Acts 2:42. They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teachings and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread and prayer. Now, I want you to notice the word and the usage that is there in Acts 2. Continually devoting themselves. Not devoting themselves on Sunday, not devoting themselves on Wednesday nights, not devoting themselves when it was convenient, devoting themselves continually. It was a non-stop process. And what were they devoting themselves to? The apostles' teachings. Keep in mind they didn't have Bibles then. So this would be tantamount to Bible study today because the apostles' teachings, that's what the Bible is now. So the apostles' teachings, fellowship, the breaking of bread, and prayer. So the breaking of bread can also refer to the worship service, the Lord's Supper. Fellowship, of course, is just being around one another, encouraging one another, being with your brothers and sisters, taking care of their needs, and, of course, to prayer. So this is something that was constant for them. It's not something that they did once a week. It's not something that they were in and out about. This was something that they were always doing. This was a part of their lifestyle, their day-to-day dealings. And I think that it's important because this is what our life should look like daily. This is what the early followers of Christ, the ones that knew Jesus best, this is what their life looked like. They were constantly studying the teachings, fellowshipping with one another, breaking bread, worshiping, and praying. Those are the four ingredients, it seems, based on this, that make up godly living, make up what a Christian walk should look like. Let's look in the next few verses. This is Acts 2:44 through 47. And those who had believed were together and had all things common. And they began selling their property and their possessions and were sharing them with all, as anyone might have need. Day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord was adding to their number, day by day, those who were being saved. God designed humans to be a community. It's part of our programming, if that's what you want to call it. We're designed to be around people. We're designed to live amongst people. We're communal beings. Even people that don't believe in God, that just believe that we're primates that evolved from, you know, some kind of ancient ape, even they believe that. They believe that we're hardwired to be around people and to seek out encouragement and acceptance from our peers. God built us that way, and he wants his church to reflect that. His plan, his grand design, was for the church to be that for people. And we're looking through the scripture, had all things in common. They were selling their own property and possessions, trying to share with those who might have need of things, taking care of one another's needs, and they were continuing with one mind. So they had a goal. They knew what they wanted to be. They knew what they wanted their lives to look like because they had been, again, studying the teachings, praying, fellowshipping. And their attitude and their behavior really reflected that. God wants the church to reflect that and reflect this communal idea that he wove into people. That's why the church is designed the way that it is. You see, God's design, his plan for us, is actually pretty simple. Sometimes we overcomplicate it. Sometimes we make it into something that it's not. But his design for us and the way that we live is actually pretty simplistic. We're supposed to love God. We're supposed to love our brothers and sisters and take care for them, look after them. If they need something, do the best that we can to fulfill that need. Not necessarily wants, not necessarily desires, but if they genuinely need something, they need help, they need comfort, whatever it is, we're supposed to be there for them. And also to grow the family. evangelize. Talk to other people in your community to help grow that family and grow that community of the church. Our goal really should be to, because we love God, want to be with Him, want to be with other people that love Him, and want the people who don't love Him, that don't understand what His plan is, to try to bring them into the fold as well, because we care for them and care for our brothers and sisters. And I want you to notice something else. Notice how strong their faith was. Notice how strong their faith was in their daily lives, that they lived out their own Christianity. And it was because of these things that they were doing, devoting themselves to the teachings, fellowship, encouraging one another, breaking bread, and praying. Guys, Christianity, the Christian life is not easy, but it is simple. And these are things that everybody can do. Sometimes it takes devotion and dedication, but they're doable. They're not that hard. Something to think about as we go through the week. I will see you on Monday morning. That's our show. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.